And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today we have the Vice President of Programming for the African American Museum of Philadelphia, Ivan Henderson. And welcome, sir. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a long time since the museum has been on the show. And for anyone who is unfamiliar with the museum, would you start today with a description of, well, your mission statement?
Certainly. The African American Museum in Philadelphia brings diverse communities together in greater appreciation of the Black experience through the combined narrative of art, culture, and historical witness. We believe that our museum will be an integral asset of the Philadelphia cultural landscape that makes a meaningful impact on visitors' lives as they experience the stories of people of African descent through art, history, and culture. That's the mission and our vision as it is written. I can go a little bit farther to say that, you know, part of our core principles is to highlight agency in African-American communities, both in contemporary narratives, but also in the history we explore.
The museum, let's go back now to the history of the museum itself, though, first. The museum was commissioned or dedicated in 1976. It was part of the bicentennial celebrations, I believe. But it's something unusual about it in that it might not be the first museum of the African American or Black experience, but it was the first one that was actually created by an actual city, the city of Philadelphia.
Yes, I think it was remarkable. Of course, you know, most folks will remember that's on the occasion of the nation's bicentennial in 1976 that this museum and several other institutions were erected. And so, you know, Philadelphia would be the focal point for America's 200th birthday. And what better setting to have an institution like this open? We all know nowadays that the founding of the museum, you know, was a result of a struggle. I mean, there was a push and pull around ideas. And so we're happy and lucky and blessed to still persist in our work today. And of course, our relationship with the city persists to this day. We had some of our city funding in doubt. Of course, just like everyone's funding was in doubt as a result of what's going on now. But we were able to have that funding restored after some deliberation. And so that's been the, you know, over 40-year relationship we've had with the city of Philadelphia. And we appreciate the ongoing support.
You know, there are so many museums in the city, and we've had some serious issues with funding for a lot of our cultural institutions. And you've had some amazing leadership over the years that has steered you through economic crisis and kept the museum doors open.
Absolutely. I've been involved with the museum for over a decade. So I've only had the benefit of working under two of those presidents and CEOs. Our current president, Patricia Wilson Aiden, who really allows me to explore new ideas and create space for our team to be daring, even at times where we're running a high risk. She really wants us to work with integrity. And Ramona Risco Benson, the person who encouraged me to stick with this and the person who convinced me that museums would be the place that I would work to have the greatest impact that I could on the communities I want to serve. So I just wanted to shout out those two leaders because in many ways they made me.
They are remarkable women. You talked about culture and art, and I remember when it opened, it was more of that brick and mortar and glass case type of an institution where you walk in and you see articles and ephemera, et cetera, et cetera. And,
yes.
And today, the shift seems to have been it's almost a conceptual exhibitions.
Yes. And I think our mission and our vision of the institution, of course, some of the words have changed, but actually in our history, the ideas haven't changed that much. Although we were sort of a history-leaning institution and the different versions of our name over the years, I think reflected that or what we were commonly known as reflected that. But also, you know, acquisitions of major and important works of art were also part of our founding, even if they were used to help illustrate and animate some of the history. They were actually works of fine art. So we're really growing back into, you know, the fullness of our mission, I'd say, over the past decade or so, and especially, you know, obviously, over the past several years.
Well, describe the museum first. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. Yeah. The museum is located at 701 Arch Street, Philadelphia. To visit you, well, visit the website, of course, get more information about opening and how it will return to us. But do you want to talk about the actual brick-and-mortar building itself and how the museum is divided up, how someone experiences the museum?
Yes, our museum is made up of four gallery spaces, which are sort of stacked on top of each other, pancake style, and connected by ramps, which actually dominate a lot of the landscape inside the building. Back in 76, you know, we folks then, you know, decided to fill our building with ramps, which of course has given us an advantage in trying to make it easy for as many folks as possible to traverse. But in addition to those four gallery spaces, we also have an auditorium in the bottom of the institution, which of course mirrors the footprint of everything above it. Our auditorium is a display area where many of our exhibitions will show. It's our Jack T. Franklin Memorial Auditorium. So that well-known 20th century photographer, the late Jack Franklin, not only left many of his objects in his photographic collection to us, but has also left behind a legacy and a body of ideas and work that our curatorial staff is able to build around. But the experience is an amp. The community building, the things that people come there for in terms of affirming identity or learning about identity and learning about ourselves and other people also occur throughout the building and in our auditorium. You're likely to encounter musical performances, theatrical performances, historical reenactments, and all sorts of activity in the space that helps us, you know, once again, animate the mission and animate the objects on display.
You got the Franklin collection, and that includes photographs from we've got like 40 years of the civil rights movement, seminal pieces, seminal examples of events that he was able to capture, and you've got them there. Is the museum, is it a reflection of the experience in America, or is it leaning towards the experience in Philadelphia, in this Delaware Valley?
Of course, it's a little bit of both. Black museums in general, African American museums writ large, many of them were founded out of a Black museums movement. And so while we're dedicated to teaching the histories of, first of all, this city and the region, there are connections, you know, across time and across oceans that we're able to explore. So we find great partnership and folks, you know, with the August Wilson Center in Pittsburgh, but we also find, you know, brotherhood and kinship in institutions across the country. So there are some larger issues that have to do with, you know, the human condition writ large for African Americans here that we're able to explore. We're always able to relate those things back to, of course, what we know locally, because none of these problems are truly disconnected. None of the issues, the triumphs, or the things we celebrate are truly disconnected.
One of the permanent exhibits is Audacious Freedom. We're, in this piece, you're looking at the first 100 years of our nation, 1776 to 1876. African Americans, blacks have been in this country since the early 1600s. You pick that particular century. Is it because it was, well, our nation's beginning, the first 100 years?
I think that in any institution, you know, in choosing a core exhibition is looking at a few things. We're looking at the strength of ideas and research we have available to us and our knowledge of the material history or the ideas that we can actually show people. But I also think that there's, you know, we're looking at the market, looking at the places we've been before. So for a number of years of our history, our core exhibition really concentrated on the transatlantic slave trade and also on the origins of Africans. Where did folks come from, you know, prior to 1619? And that's a story that we continue to tell through our objects. But with Audacious Freedom, we're looking at the historic neighborhood that we're a part of, all of the objects in history that's walking distance from our institution, and made a deliberate choice to provide on-ramps both into our discourse, but also for our visitors into the broader discourse going on in the historic community. So if you can walk to the Constitution Center from here, even the Museum of the American Revolution, of course, was yet to be built at the time, but we even had inklings about, you know, developments going on. And so we were able to join into the broader narratives of our historic district while remaining true to our core mission. And so I think it was something, I won't say it's that simple, but I think it was a high impact decision that's changed the way we're able to talk to our communities and folks outside of our community for the past 10 years.
You're incorporating in there, you have the revolution. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, my sense of history, was it advantageous to back a new country, the United States, when Britain was probably more liberating, was actually already emancipated?
So I don't want to spoil the experience for anyone, but I can say that and many other tension-filled questions, which require critical thinking, are the sorts of things that we explore both with the workshop facilitators at our institution, but also our talented core of docents. I mean, we literally wrestle with each other around those questions and ideas, find all the evidence that we can provide to our audiences, and then invite them to work with us to co-author meaning out of those moments. As luck would have it, or as bad luck would have it, however you want to think of it, when tragedies and triumphs occur in our communities, or things that greatly concern large groups of African Americans occur, we're able to look back at that time period and ask those critical questions again and find out if the answers have become any easier.
You get beyond the discourse of support or not. In the revolution, this also covers the Civil War and the horrendous periods that preceded that. Here in Philadelphia, we keep talking about like it's a battle of North and South, but that came after years of the nativism riots, and yes, this city had a terrible history going into the Civil War. And then you end 10 years after the Civil War when we're still in the Reconstruction. There was a question in there somewhere.
Yes. I think it's, it's an important and pivotal century for this country, for this world. For us, we're engaged in the business of highlighting untold truths and bringing more folks' master narratives together to help tell a more complex picture. So from the complex relationship that Africans at the time, who would then become African Americans, would have had around the Revolutionary War era, to the complex relationships that, you know, led up to, persisted through and followed, you know, the Civil War era and Reconstruction. All of these things are mirrored in the tension and the different, you know, the complex set of issues facing all of our communities today, including African-American communities. So for me, that tension really means that you can't tie a bow around history and make it all pretty. It's never pretty, and it's never a sort of a closed book. It's only a lead-in into another chapter of another great book. And so we value all of that tension and believe it's part of what brings our audiences back to us, is that we are engaged in truth-telling in all of its beauty and in all of its ugliness. And there's plenty of that going on as we analyze the years between 1776 and 1876. And upon reflection, there's plenty for us to think about today.
If you are just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Ivan Henderson. He is the Vice President of Programming for the African American Museum of Philadelphia. And for more information about anything that we are talking about today, and as I alluded to earlier, as we are reopening our museums and we're getting back out there, watch this site for information. information about when the doors will open up again, aampmuseum.org, aampmuseum.org. Information about everything that we've talked about, exhibits, hours, online programming that is available to you. You just alluded to the truth and history is not always very pretty. And I think a lot of Philadelphians would be truly amazed at what went down, what happened in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. Here in Philadelphia, we think, oh, well, it was a northern state. We don't realize that there were racial issues, ethnic issues between all of the factions in this city, and that we had a strong Southern sympathy streak because of our economy here in manufacturing. Do you find that a lot of us just don't know the history of this city?
I find that a lot of folks may have, you know, blank spots, and especially the farther back you go. You know, part of my answer to that is the responsibility of institutions like ours. You know, there's this new history coming out and being made every day. It is up to us to find those connections across centuries, and to be able to highlight what we're seeing today that mirrors in so many ways what we've seen in the past, or at least understand that we're on a continuum. And understand where we are on that timeline today in, you know, wise relationship to what we've seen in the past and what we know about the past. And so I think that if we did learn more of that history from the early 19th century in this region, we may be less confused about some of the friction that persists today. And in fact, we have to highlight these things in order to address them and to deal with them. It's not about piling on one group or another. It really is about sharing all the information that we have in order to move forward together, if that is our real desire. And so, you know, throughout African-American history, we've seen, you know, just in the past 100 years, organizations rise and persist, others rise and fall after a time, but all engaged in some of the same work that's being done today by activists. Some of these were by, for, and about African-Americans, and some of these movements were inclusive of others, just like we're seeing today. We see that in the past 100 years, and in the 100 years before that, and in the 100 years before that. And so I think, you know, to varying degrees. So I think it's important for institutions, when we have a moment, to seize the moment and highlight those connections in surprising, engaging, and fun ways when possible, or at least in ways that spark people to think critically about what they're experiencing today.
How do you present this? Is it through artifacts? Is it through written word? Is it through the facilitators and the storytellers? How do you tell the story of this period?
It is all of the above. The Audacious Freedom Period, especially experience in our museum, is a media-rich experience. There are a number of visuals around the galleries, but much of the visitor experience is driven by scrolling images and moving images on monitors throughout the galleries. And so you have an opportunity to, you know, quote unquote, meet historic figures and see, quote unquote, historic objects and documents, many of which we, of course, wouldn't have in our permanent collection, but see things from that time period represented through digital means in the gallery. Beyond that, of course, we have our traveling trunk program, which we're trying to translate into a virtual space right now, which really brings into your hands objects that would have had to do with the personal, political, and professional lives of African Americans from different time periods. So in learning about Octavius Caddo, he, of course, was a civil rights leader. He was an educator. He enlisted and fought in the Civil War. He agitated for the Black vote. He also was a man of science and was a person who enjoyed cricket and enjoyed sports. And so we're able to look at the whole person and in some ways imagine ourselves engaged in some of their heroic actions just by seeing how much like us they are. We also have our historical reenactors, of course, who really bring history to life. But we also think of object as the idea as object. Of course, we want the historic artifact, the physical, tangible thing there, which isn't as valuable these days because we're not in the building. And so we have to think of Black intellectual thought as object, and ideas as object, in addition to all of these documents and other things that you see in museums. It allows us to be flexible in the ways that we present things to people, and allows us, you know, to not have to wait until we turn over the galleries to explore new ideas and themes.
Now, Octavius Cato was an educator. He was a teacher, an educator himself. What kind of educational programming do you offer? And you are still a research institute as well, are you not?
Yes, we do not conduct, we don't produce scholarly materials at this time. We do regularly engage in research partnerships with individuals and institutions around the region, of course, to help us learn and unlock the mysteries of our own collection, but also to advance scholarship for individuals who are interested. One of the things I'm most excited about is the thing that we do with our interns from high school to undergrad to graduate school. Every year, we also work with several young people who engage in their own small personal research projects, some of them for credit, some of them are not. But in all cases, they're pursuing a new line of thought and often, you know, highlight something or teach us something about ourselves or the collection. Beyond that, everything that we do in the museum, we've made available over the years outside of the museum. So all of the workshops, the facilitated learning experiences, but we also, with our traveling trunk program, bring out middle school leveled teacher's guides and lesson plans that go along with it and can drive classroom discussions and activities for 2 weeks. We also have with Audacious Freedom, our core exhibition, both teacher guides and student guides that are also available for the same reason, for you to link the objects and ideas in the exhibition to some of the standards driven goals that you would be pursuing in the classroom or even in a homeschool setting. And so we continue with that. Since we've been closed, everything that we do physically, we've begun to translate into a virtual space. So when you visit our website, you'll visit our virtual campus space. It should be one of the most prominent things you see there, where it's a collection of our virtual exhibits, our of course, upcoming virtual programs that you can register for, as well as recordings of past virtual programs, and our educational resources, our lesson plans, our arts and craft activity prompts, all drawn from themes that have to do with today, Black communities during times of pandemic, things that have to do with sort of those larger themes we explore in Audacious Freedom, as well as, you know, highlighting and translating some of the major ideas from the art, the fine art in our collection.
Talk a moment or two about the art, though.
Yes, and our museum do have a rich collection of objects. Most recently, this past year, Sheldon Bonovitz donated a number of works by artist Purvis Young, which offers us a new opportunity to explore something with our communities. Purvis Young was an artist who you know, many might call an outsider artist, some would call autodidact or self-taught. I think he was a little bit more complex than that, but part of his history was being incarcerated and refining part of his craft there. Part of what we're doing with that donation of artworks are highlighting the narratives of folks who have been incarcerated, the effects on families and communities. So there's a historic bent to the things we can do with these works, but also a straight up, you know, art history conversation that we can have about artists like him. When we do reopen to the public this fall, whenever it happens, we'll be putting on a new exhibition in partnership with Mural Arts Philadelphia, as well as the Reimagining Reentry Program. This exhibition is called Rendering Justice, which features works by a contemporary group of formerly incarcerated artists. So we're able to tell a long story and a short story through the objects in our collection. And of course, going back, works by Barbara Bullock, some very special works by Barclay Hendrix, and all of the names, Martina Johnson Allen, our artist in residence, Richard Watson, and too many artists to name, are all part of our art collection. We're able to bring them out and interpret them in our collection-based shows, and also able to borrow objects and use them to fill out what we have in our collection to explore certain themes.
What about membership? Do you want to talk and touch upon your partners, and also about how people can get involved through volunteerism, through donation, and again, membership to the museums?
Yes, and this is one of those cases where we want all of the above, we need all of the above, and I'm asking for all of the above. Membership for our institution not only, you know, makes it so that a number of our rich and enriching programs and experiences are free or at a reduced price to folks. For us, it also demonstrates the level of community support for our institution. You know, the number of people and families and households who value this institution. Of course, it's wind beneath my wings because I work there, but I also think we always need to show the broader community our value, and showing the commitment of members and all that they bring to the institution is one way. Of course, we ask for donations from individuals, from foundations, from people who value our work and want to see institutions like ours thrive. That's $5, $5,000, however folks want to give it. And we've gotten a little bit wiser about knowing when and how to ask and making sure that we seize every opportunity to ask. And so I'm doing this here. But also one of my favorite ways of feeling and recognizing community support is through volunteerism. There are a number of opportunities for volunteers at our museum, especially when our doors are open, from staffing our events to supporting us in our phone-a-thons and our fundraising efforts and advocacy efforts and letter writing and everything else. But our small army of volunteer docents, the people who continue to imagine new ways to serve our audiences even now, are the folks who are both members of the museum, but also great contributors to the mission and to our core functions. And probably one of the ways that even right now, a person who is interested could get involved. Our docents are still kicking. They're still working. And like I said, they are literally producing new products and new ways of interfacing with audiences while we're still home. And many of these ideas will be evergreen ideas that we can bring back into the physical space once our doors are open again.
We are out of time, but when we go to aampmuseum.org, what do we find?
You will find, first of all, everything you need to know about our history and our mission, but most importantly, our upcoming goings-on. Whether you enter our virtual campus tab, where you see all of our education, public programming, and exhibition offerings bundled together, or you click on our calendar, you can get an opportunity to see the types of events that we have coming up, as well as some of our history of events that we've put on over the years, and some of the things that we've done in response to the current closures. Part of what we do are look for the big messages in African-American history and produce work that should resonate across time. And so we find that things we were already working on around Juneteenth, around African-American community, public health issues, we find have particular resonance at this time. But through our virtual campus, we also get to show that we are able to be nimble and respond to right up to the minute to discussions of today. And so you'll find all of that at our website, on our calendar, and of course, through all of our social media portals.
That website is aampmuseum.org for the African-American Museum of Philadelphia, aampmuseum.org. And my guest today, the Vice President of Programming for the African-American Museum of Philadelphia, Ivan Henderson, thank you for being on today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the platform for AMP.
You are always welcome back. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.